morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and our podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit whose programs include the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. Come visit Bookmarks at our community gathering space and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Inside the Writer's Studio is also proud to be an affiliate of Libro FM, the audiobook platform that supports your local independent bookstore. Stay tuned at the end of the podcast for more information on Libro FM and a special offer. My guest today is Sarah Langan, whose novel, A Better World, was just published. Sarah, welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio.
Thank you.
I was reading about your earlier novels, and one reviewer called your novel Good Neighbors, quote, one of the creepiest, most unnerving deconstructions of American suburbia I have ever read. And in your new novel, A Better World, we have sort of another view of suburbia that is fairly dark. I wonder what is it about suburbia that makes you want to kind of pull it apart and look at the layers and the darkness underneath?
Well, I grew up in suburbia, so I think we often write what we know. But I'm also always surprised when people talk about how dark my stuff is, because I think, well, I'm just looking at things from a particular perspective, and they seem true. I'm not saying like there's all these secrets and we're revealing them. I think most people know and have intuitions about a place or a person, and I think what's interesting about these stories is why these secrets exist, why these affectations are nurtured, why a veneer is important, and what they're covering. And I think everything is like that.
Yeah. So there's a tradition in film and literature. I saw one of these films recently, and I can't remember the name of it. And I think you could even argue that the new Barbie film was a little bit like this, where this idea of sort of a closed, ideal, perfect community, like the Stepford Wives, that looks really wonderful at first glance, but once we learn more about it, we start to see the problems, the weaknesses, the underlying sort of dangers of it. And you have a community like that at the center of this novel, a community called Plymouth Valley. So tell us a little bit about Plymouth Valley and about how it kind of, I think, builds on that tradition, but also goes in some new directions.
Is it the Olivia Wilde movie that you were thinking of?
Yeah, I think that's the one. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't seen that. People have brought that up to me, so I probably should. So Plymouth Valley is this near future corporate town. And I don't know if you've studied any of these old corporate towns, but the corporation would own everything. And the employees would be cared for. They live in houses. They would get their food. They would get everything, even their medicine, on sort of corporate largesse. And they often weren't paid. And in that situation, they eventually revolted in a lot of these towns. But in Plymouth Valley, which is this future town, these employees are treated beautifully. They have everything they could possibly want. And not only that, but there are high walls keeping strangers out. Their houses are cleaned. Their kids go to excellent schools. And they have this future that other people outside the company town don't have, because their kids are going to get jobs and going to get paid and be able to live in Plymouth Valley, where the air is clean and the water is clean and the food is clean and plentiful. Whereas outside, I have this notion that things have fallen apart even more. And unemployment's at 20% or 25%. And people who are hardworking and doing their best are still unable to make ends meet. Not only that, but there are the health impacts of dirty air and global warming. So you'd want to live in Plymouth Valley. And I don't know if you've ever been to Google's offices, but I would want to work for Google. Yeah, they like do everything for you, and they take care of your kids, and everyone is nice. Like you just have fun all the time while working.
I remember in high school, my film studies teacher, we were studying Hitchcock, and he said that the Hitchcock protagonist is an ordinary person in extraordinary circumstances. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about the family, the Farmer Bowens, who are at the center of this narrative. who arrive in Plymouth Valley at the beginning of the book. Tell us a little bit about them, and if you think that that Hitchcockian description fits the their circumstance.
I think you're exactly right, and I actually was thinking about that. And you know, Hitchcock, his dad didn't bail him out of jail, and he had to stay in jail overnight, and it affected him. He was always scared of authority after that, and he always knew after that that he wasn't safe. And that actually happened to my dad too in the Bronx. Like, they thought he was a protester, but he was actually just going to med school or whatever. And like, and my grandpa wouldn't pick him up. My grandpa was like, let him learn his lesson, not to hang out with riffraff. And my dad was always, he would warn me. He'd be like, you don't know. You don't know. They could drag you away. And like, it sounds ridiculous. You know, like, I'm this white girl from the suburbs, and like, this is the lesson I've been taught. I'm sure a lot of people have, you know, greater justification to think that than I do. But I have this notion that things will more and more go in that direction, at least in the story of A Better World, where you can't trust the edifices, the foundations of society to protect you anymore. And we have this family who would just like to survive and be happy and to bequeath more to their children than they had. And it looks more and more like that's not going to happen. And then they get the offer to live in Plymouth Valley. And they have to take it. There's just no, you couldn't say no to that. It would be absurd. And so they move there knowing full well that the people are weird, that it's inappropriate to not be paid for your work and to instead have a lease on a house and the promise of eventually, you know, if you get lucky, they give you a ticket. They know everything about it and they know the people are strange, but they do it because it's the only thing that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so now they have to figure out how to live there. And the more they learn about these people, the more they think there's something really wrong.
Yeah. One of the residents of Plymouth Valley says, we think of Plymouth Valley as the last lifeboat. And I wonder if you could talk about this, this sort of twin thing that's going on here, where we have the, yeah, we have the ideal community above ground, but we also have this post-apocalyptic preparation sort of going on below ground.
So my friend Jenny Perlin made a movie about a year ago. I don't remember the name of it, but it was about preppers. Mm-hmm. And in it, she visits all of these bomb shelters that are underground, or they're these silos in the middle of the country. And they cost millions of dollars. And some people, like companies, are making them and selling them. And you look at them and you think, well, that's good, I guess, if there's like a disease that kills everyone, but otherwise, and then you're just going to live there by yourself forever. I don't know. Or, I mean, it's not going to withstand a nuclear impact or an asteroid. It doesn't make a ton of sense. Mm-hmm. And what it also implies is that you're not really interested in fixing things. Like, this is a lot of money to spend unscrew the world, mm-hmm. I think. And so in Plymouth Valley, you know, they've got these walls, but they also have this huge survivor shelter underground. And it's made to withstand the impact of an asteroid or a nuclear attack. And the notion is you could just live there for 50 years or more. But I've got a lot of questions about the kinds of people who would do that and the kinds of people who think that other people aren't worth working together with. Because really, the only way to make the world any better is through collaboration and sacrifice. It is not through, you know, digging a hole and burying yourself in it.
There, you write about this, what's going on in the outside world, outside of Plymouth Valley, as the era of great unwinding. And one of the things that's portrayed as an element that is eating at the heart of human society here, in addition to all the, you know, environmental issues and economic issues, is just simply human anger. And I wondered to what extent you sort of the era of great unwinding emotionally is reflecting some of what's going on in America today.
There's a ton of anger today. And I think it's obviously fanned by social media. It's fanned by politics, and it's fanned by these notions. Like, it just feels like a lot of smoke screens, and people are fighting very much over the wrong things, and they're very much not seeing what they agree on. And I know this is what people have been saying for years, but it's still true. And there are these algorithms messing with us and pitting us against each other. But on top of that, there are some kind of dystopian things that have been happening with the direction of technology and the direction of the ways that consumers are being abused by technology. And this is like the tiniest example, but I was on the phone yesterday trying to get a hotel reservation changed, and I had to call in, and it took 2 hours because their line kept hanging up. And by the third, like, I had a nice time talking to the lady the first time. I was like, this is nice. We're picking a new hotel. This is a lovely experience. But then she hung up on me. And then I called the next again. And the new person, I said, you got to take my number and call me back. And she said, well, I'm not allowed. And I said, okay. And then she hung up on me. And then I called again. And then this woman, I raised my voice with. And I was like, I'm raising my voice with someone. And then I had to talk to a manager, and the manager fixed it. You've heard this story a billion times, but it does feel like it's a part of our life built in. It's maybe 2 hours of crap that we didn't have before. And we thought technology was going to make things easier. And I'm not sure that it has.
Yeah. One of the things on the topic of technology, there's this one of these quotes of your book that just popped out at me is when they first arrive, they notice. Everybody has something they call their device, but beyond that, there's a lot of analog in Plymouth Valley. Somebody says, everyone has notebooks. We don't believe in screens. Screens are for consumers. Our children are producers. I love that idea. Can you talk a little bit about your perception of digital and analog media and how that's treated in the novel?
I mean, most of these rich tech guys send their kids to Waldorf schools where screens aren't allowed because they know it's bad for them. And they know very well that it's their market. It's a drug. It's not something they want to expose their children to. And I think COVID really, I don't like that my kids have to bring a charged laptop to school every day. I think we got suckered somewhere along the line. And I think the people who should be valued, the teachers, aren't being listened to. It's these tech companies selling product that we just keep buying. So there's that, you know. So I'm not even exaggerating what Plymouth Valley is doing with its people, saying like, this isn't, you know, you can't be on social media. That's absurd. Like, that's for our consumers so we can get all their data. And everyone's relieved. No one wants to be on social media in the town. And analog makes a lot more sense also because you can't be monitored. So if you're doing anything illegal, you certainly are going to do it analog. You're not going to do it where it can be found.
The Farmer Bowens, I think almost even before they go, but certainly soon after they arrive, they recognize this idea that Plymouth Valley is really too good to be true, that it can't possibly be as this wonderful thing that's being presented to them. And yet they reach for that brass ring anyhow. What is it about human nature, you think, that makes us, even when we understand there's no way in the world I'm going to win the lottery, we still buy the ticket. We still say, there's got to be something wrong here, but I'm moving to Plymouth Valley anyhow.
I think they look at the options as you would, and their options are They can't pay the mortgage. The wife is coughing all the time because of the algae blooms. And their kids are half the time not going to school because of shooter threats or somebody's sick and everybody's got to Zoom in. And they go to this place where that's not the case. And why wouldn't you do it? Even if you think, hey, I might be making the world worse by going here. I might be leaving the fight. I was doing good on the outside. I'm not going to be doing good anymore. I'll just be like in this little enclave where the only people we're helping are ourselves. Might be worth it. Certainly if you have kids, it's worth it. And certainly if you have to put up with a few jerks, it's worth it. Clean air, education, not having to worry. These are the most basic needs of humans. It's just survival. I'd do the deal without thinking twice about it. And I'd know it was wrong. But you'd be crazy. You'd be wrong to do the other thing. You'd be wrong to say, listen, you know, we have to make this moral stand, even if we all get really sick, even if we're homeless. No, like it's a crazy, you just wouldn't do it.
Let's talk about structure for a minute. I love the way this novel is structured. And in particular, I love these little information sheets about Plymouth Valley that sort of kick off every section. Can you tell us a little bit about how you structure the novel and how those little information pamphlets kind of interact with the narrative?
So I have this character who's the granddaughter of the founder of the town. Her name is Inuk, and she thinks she's a genius, and she talks a lot about eugenics. She's super into eugenics and like epigenetics, and she has all these theories about how like the reason people are sick on the outside is because like they have abusive backgrounds and it carries through generations and it makes people not desirable to live in the town. All this crazy stuff. And so I pictured her as the author of these pamphlets that are like how to get along in Plymouth Valley. And that's they're just silly and kind of vapid, and they were so fun to write. And I just imagine these brochures that you get when you go to like a hotel and you're like, what is this? Like, this is ridiculous. Did a kid draw this? And that's her. And then on top of that, I have these, I wanted to give the reader an idea of what happens, what's going on the outside, because we only have the Farmer Bones perspective. So they're living inside Plymouth Valley, but I wanted the reader to have a wider view so they could see the impact of the decisions the Farmer Bones were making and had made. And they could see the wider effect that Plymouth Valley and its corporate holder, like the parent company Better World, had on the world. So, you know, it was fun. And I tried to do it so that it was in some ways rewarding to the reader, because you get through this part and then you get to have a little joke and you get to have a little comment. You're like, oh, I found this out. And then that makes me more interested in reading.
Yeah, it definitely reminded me of, I mean, any town you go to, you get the little pamphlet, why our town is special, you know, and but then it's sort of like, very strange things in it. And the other documents that crop up in the novel are these sort of these excerpts from what feel like academic studies that are happening in the future. We don't really know exactly how far in the future. I can't remember. Do we know exactly when the novel takes place? It's just sort of near future. But we have these academic studies that seem to be from maybe 25, 50 years later. Looking back on some of these events, tell us a little bit about that and how, you know, how that casts a different light on the novel.
Well, so when I was writing my last book, Good Neighbors, I wanted to write something that a reader could not put down. Like they just couldn't, you know? And so I read Carrie, and then I studied Carrie, you know, Stephen King's book, because you can't put that book down.
Yeah.
You're like, oh my God. She like had a period, people threw things. This is terrible. But what's also interesting about Carrie is King delivers a spoiler halfway through, or maybe even less than halfway, saying that Carrie dies. And I remember reading it and I was like, no, she doesn't. No, she doesn't. And like, it made me crazy. It made me read that much faster. And it's sort of the opposite of the intent, like what you would think would happen. You would think a reader would go, well, I'm angry now. But no, if you're really into it. So I was thinking about that too. I was thinking about the ways that I might be able to deliver information to a reader that would sort of pique their interest in those ways of like, hey, you know, this might happen. And like, so that was the intention.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of those excerpts from academic books where I go, well, I want to read this whole book. Is she gonna write that for me? I love the existence, and I do this some of my own novels, the existence of fictional books. That is to say, books within fictional works that don't really exist, where we play around with this sort of slightly meta world. And I love the way that is accomplished in this novel.
So my third novel, Audrey's Door, I made up a religion called Chaotic Naturalism. And then I made up a website for it. But if you clicked through, it would take you to Ghostbusters and Ivan Reitman and all these like very silly things.
Yeah.
But when I was touring for it, no one believed me. I was like, I made it up. It's not a real religion. And people were like, it is.
Oh, no.
Like that was my first like, wow, fake news can really like mess with people because no one will believe me.
Let's talk about this idea of made up religion for a minute, because there is this thing in Plymouth Valley called Hollow, which is, it's kind of a set of traditions. It's described as like a religion, but not. Somebody else says it's more about ritual than about belief. What do you think? Talk about the place of Hollow in the novel and the way that it kind of comments on the place of both religion and tradition and ritual in society in general.
I think, first off, like in a better world, Hollow is this evolved set of cultures. And it was used like corporate culture uses retreats. This is what we do. This is how we do it. We wear this uniform. We do these events. We have these races. We have these festivals. And they're civic bonding. But over time, what happens is while all the people say it's just for fun, it's not a religion, it slowly begins to become a religion. And they begin to believe in it. Just as, you know, there's this, you know, growing up, it was my dad used to always say, there, but for the grace of God, go I. And it was like, you know, this could happen to anyone. And I think the more privileged you get, the less you want to believe that. The more you want to believe, I have a divine right. I wasn't lucky. I earned this. I'm actually special. And I think this Hollow religion really appeals to people for that reason. They can say like, it bonds them, but it also validates and justifies their actions and the actions of the pretty terrible things that their corporation is doing. And because they're the geniuses behind the corporation, they're doing, though they couldn't possibly allow themselves to admit it or even put the pieces together to build the story. So we have that. But then I think we're seeing right now, I'm like afraid to say it, you know, but I think what we're seeing right now is a rise of fundamentalism and a rise. What I'm very, very suspicious of, particularly as a woman, because religion tends to not be so kind to women, is when people say, I know what God thinks, therefore you must do this because of what God thinks. And it's like, we have a government and we have a set of rules, like don't commit murder because it's bad for society. I don't really need someone else telling me what God says. Like, I don't need interpreters. And there seem to be more and more interpreters of God right now.
One of the things I found, you know, as I've started to read the details of Plymouth Valley and how it works, I'm imagining your process in crafting this community, which makes me question as a reader, for me, what would be the ideal community? like if I were creating the ideal community for myself. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that. Like, to what extent do your own ideas about what would be a perfect community contribute to Plymouth Valley? And to what extent do you pull it away from what would be perfect for you?
You know, I recently watched It's a Wonderful Life. It's like my favorite movie. I love it so much. And in it, we just have Bedford Falls. And I love Bedford Falls. And it's so imperfect. And George Bailey's life is sad. And his kid gets sick because his house is drafty. And like, he's just doing this job that's thankless, but it's helping people. And his life has meaning. And I think a meaningful life based on community and relationships and friends is more than we should hope for. It's the best we can hope for, not in a bleak way. Like, life is hard, but it's also good and meaningful. And I think I've always been, a lot of my stories, my first story, the novel, The Keeper, the town is called Bedford for a reason. It's sort of the Pottersville version. And Pottersville is my nightmare. It's a place where the community is ripped apart because of money. And I think that capitalism is great. Capitalism gets people to trade instead of having wars between each other. But there have to be some structures in place to keep it from skewing to the point where there's these monopolies.
Let's talk about the economics of it for a minute. A lot of the people who work in Plymouth Valley doing, you know, menial jobs, whether it be cleaning or cooking or, you know, maintenance, those sort of things, they don't actually live in Plymouth Valley. They live elsewhere and have to come in. And it reminded me very much of going to these resort islands where I see school buses coming off of the island, not full of school children, but full of people who work on that island but can't afford to live there. They have to live in a more lower class community somewhere else. Talk about what the novel has to say about class.
Well, it's this idea of, I think, that people of privilege have, that they've just made smarter decisions, when that's not at all true. And I think also the people of privilege are frightened of the outsiders. And some of them even think they carry disease. And it's a way of removing themselves from the reality that it could just as easily be them. And I think the outsiders resent they live in Plymouth Valley Extension. And they resent the people from Plymouth Valley, because the people from Plymouth Valley are slowly stealing all the resources. And I think just, you know, the nature of power is to keep it. The nature of power is to grow and accumulate. And if there's no regulation, that's exactly what will happen.
There's Linda, at one point, she says to herself, she expresses this fear that if you live in Plymouth Valley too long, you become inhuman, as she describes it. Tell us a little bit about Linda, without spoilers, tell us a little bit about her, how she reacts to this new community, and why it is that she has a fear of losing her humanity.
So Linda grew up in a town, I think Poughkeepsie, and in my version of the story, people were marketed this fix-all drug. And the drug turned out to be incredibly addictive. And it was given to everyone for anxiety, for everything. And so her town was a test town for it. And it decimated her town. And it decimated her family. And what she understood was, like, this is a corporate issue. It's very parallel to OxyContin. And so she became a pediatrician to kind of help her own childhood, to look back and save herself a little bit, but also because it was the only answer she could have provided to herself to how to get out of this and to free herself of it. And so what she's been doing in Brooklyn is working at a free clinic. But I don't know if you've noticed this, but doctors aren't getting paid anymore. And I think that's only for now going to get worse. So, and it particularly, you know, if you're a rich person, then you just pay the doctor cash and then don't worry because insurance isn't going to cover it. And so there's plenty of private doctors in her world, but she's not a private doctor. She's a public doctor. She doesn't have the income. And her husband works at the EPA. And as soon as he is fired, they're in serious trouble because her job can't support anybody. And so that's why they moved to Plymouth Valley. But once she's there, nobody needs healthcare. They're healthy. And there's so much medicine and it's so state of the art that she's just putting butterfly bandages on fingers at the little spot they'll give her. They won't really give her work anyway. And she's doing it for free. So she runs into some people who offer her a job as a clinic in Plymouth Valley Extension. And she jumps at the chance. She cannot wait. She's like, I get to actually take care of sick people. This is all I want to do. And she gets to Plymouth Valley Extension. And the trouble is nobody will show up, even though there's plenty of sick people there. They don't trust Plymouth Valley. And so she's got to earn their trust. But she also begins to think maybe there's a reason. Maybe there's a reason these people don't trust Plymouth Valley. And it compromises her ability to help them. And it compromises her integrity as she begins to understand more and more about what her job is and everyone else's job is.
And what about her relationship with her husband in particular, but also with her kids? How does the marriage play out as they come under these, you know, they've been under a lot of pressure in the outside world, and now they're under a sort of a different kind of pressure in Plymouth Valley. And how does that play out in their personal relationship?
Well, she was a very independent person. She was, you know, what you'd consider a feminist and a free spirit. And then she got married and had kids. And what happened to her is what happens to most women who do that, which is she stayed at home. She really didn't have much choice. And her husband worked harder. And suddenly they had a huge power dynamic skew where he got to do what he wanted and she did not. And she has some resentments from that. And he's kind of clueless to it. And so we start the story with that. And we get into Plymouth Valley. And we see the ways that these early decisions in their marriage have made all of these fractures that become more and more apparent the more pressure is placed on them. And we see the ways that they fundamentally disagree with who they are, with their goals, with what they ought to be doing in the world. And then the same thing happens with the kids, because the kids have different points of view too. The daughter, Josie, loves Brooklyn. You know, she's a soccer star. She's outgoing. She's kind of a tough talker. But the son, Hip, is like a little different and maybe a little neurodivergent. And people, you know, the only reason people liked him was because his sister made them. They tolerated him. So they get to Plymouth Valley in the reverse. Like, nobody likes the big loudmouth kid who's a terror on the soccer field. They like the quiet one who knows his place. And so everybody, there's just this huge upheaval in the family and the ways that they regard each other and the ways they talk to each other that impact the plot.
Linda at one point recalls learning what she calls the joy of secrets. She says they nest inside you and make you feel less lonely. Without giving away too many of the secrets of this novel, could you talk about this idea for Linda, this place of secrets in her life and why they're important to her?
I think she's been through so much in her life, and her relationship with her husband is such that she doesn't feel he'd understand a lot of the thoughts on her mind. And so in many ways, she's internal. And I think it's a tug of war because she understands that some of these secrets can be very harmful. But also, it kind of feels good. You almost get an oxytocin high from keeping a secret. There's one specific, the thing that you're referencing is very much sort of, Linda is not an addict, but it's sort of what addicts like about secrets, I think. And it's something about Plymouth Valley because no one discloses anything in Plymouth Valley. And there's a power to that. There's a power to holding things over others who are asking questions.
Linda's boss at one point says that the people of Plymouth Valley aren't living, they're avoiding death. I mean, this might get back a little bit to your to the preps, but what's the difference between living and avoiding death, especially as Linda sees it?
I think it's making decisions by fear. As soon as you start saying, well, I'm the reason I'm doing this is because I'm afraid, you're not living anymore. And your life will get smaller and smaller, and you will be less and less happy. I think that's just how it is. So there's that, but there's also, I think, a lack of exposure for the people of Plymouth Valley, where they have lived inside so long that they're terrified. And there's this one character, like the granddaughter that I was talking about, Anouk, the granddaughter of the founder. She should be the happiest lady in town, right? She's got everything, but she's got this disapproving father. And there's something wrong with her son. And Linda is kind of shocked because Linda goes to visit her and sees that she doesn't live in the main mansion house. Instead, she lives in a shed, not even a nice guest house, where there's a mattress on the floor. And I think when you're not a person who directly has power, when you're someone who just kisses up to power and hopes to get some power by nature of nearness, that's your life. And so you have an entire town where there's like two people with real power and thousands of people just doing anything to get it and sleeping on metaphorical mattresses. I mean, they can't even buy a bed. They just have to hope someone assigns them a nice bed and smile, because you can't complain there.
So I can't let you go without making one other comment about this book, which is not a spoiler because it's the first thing anybody's going to see. And that is the spectacular front cover. I just adore it. Did you have any input in that? What was your impression of it?
I was like, this is so good. I have no notes. Like, I don't even know, you know, you usually need a minute. For me, I need like a week. I got back an hour later and I was like, I think I love it. Like, I think it's amazing and perfect. I can't believe what a wonderful job they did. I wrote them before they designed the cover, 30 or 40 pages synopsis with themes and like highlights. Like, they must have thought I was insane. And I was like, maybe you want to know all this about it. But I can't get over how nice it is. And it's so pretty.
For our listeners, you will enjoy this cover. And if like me, I read mostly NetGalley stuff. So I see it on my iPad. And of course, the first thing I did was I thought, well, it's upside down. So I turned it upside down and it's still upside down. And it was really wonderful to have your mind kind of messed with in that way, just by looking at the front cover of the book. I thought it was great. Well, we like to end every episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. You should be able to answer each in just a few words, but hopefully they'll give us some insight into you and into your writing. So we shall begin. What word do you love to work into your writing?
Saturnine.
What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
Gingerly.
Where's your favorite place to write?
My garage.
Where could you never write?
Coffee shop.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
Commas.
What's the first book you remember reading?
Dory and the Dreamyard Monsters by Patricia Coombs.
What are you reading now?
I am reading The Book of Love by Kelly Link.
What book would you like to have written?
Strangers on a Train.
Oh, yeah. What sort of book would you like to write, but probably never will?
Nonfiction study of women in America and prostitution.
And finally, what would you like to hear a reader tell you?
This is my favorite book, and it changed my life.
This has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and my guest today has been Sarah Langan, whose novel, A Better World, is available wherever books are sold. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Inside the Writer's Studio is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a community gathering place and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks and all its programs, visit www.bookmarksnc.org. Inside the Writer's Studio is proud to be affiliated with Libro FM. Unlike other audiobook platforms, Libro FM supports your local independent bookstore. Whether you buy a single book or, like me, a monthly subscription, you can link your account to your local store or to Bookmarks to support literary community. For a special 2-for-1 offer, go to Libro.fm and use the discount code WRITERS. If you've enjoyed Inside the Writer's Studio, please consider leaving a rating or review online at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Inside the Writer's Studio posts new episodes on the 1st and 15th of every month. I'm hoping to get in a few more episodes before I take my summer vacation. But until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.